Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to London. Welcome to ISB and joint session with FASB this morning. Thank you for submitting comment letters in time, or nearly in time. Some of them came over the weekend, which was good reading. My role will be to be the chairman for this morning. I'm Philippe Danjou, ISB board member. A couple of admins. We will have an alarm sounding at 10. Don't panic, just a test. We should not be too much annoyed by this, I hope. Facilities, men's and women's room, are just to the left here when you get out if you need. In terms of microphones, I have switched all microphones on, so you are now live online. Please behave. If you want to say something to your neighbor, maybe you have to lean back a little bit. In terms of speaking, if you wish to take the floor, please put your name card up, and we will try to keep track of all that. And if someone wants to react immediately to something which a colleague has said and you have a burning point to make, please raise two hands so that we can give you some priority to the floor. Patrina and Lisa are going to run the session. My role is very limited, but maybe we could start with some introductions and so that everyone knows who is around the table. Maybe I start with you, Patrina.
Patrina Buchanan, ISB staff.
Anna Heining, ISB staff.
Nick Evans, Transforming Finance.
Jedrick Lee, Fidelity Worldwide.
Peter Hogarth, PwC.
Julian Lyon, Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors.
Henry Rees, ISB staff.
Jay Palmer, British Vehicle Rent and Leasing Association.
Norbert Panek, Deutsche Telekom.
Simon Nardecchia, Swiss Holdings.
Stephen Cooper, ISB.
Pascal Mourvier, GDF Suez.
Good morning, Mr. Cosper, FASB staff.
Good morning, Mike Monahan, American Council of Life Insurers.
Good morning, Susan Cook from Global Ship Lease.
Hal Schroeder, board member at FASB.
Tom Mansell from the Netherlands Authority for the Financial Markets and chair of the IFRS Project Group of ESMA.
Johan Engstrom, ISB board member.
David Maxwell, Classic Technology.
Sue Lloyd, ISB staff.
Trevor Dolan, Deloitte.
Andrew Watchman, Grant Thornton.
Lisa Mielbauer, FASB staff.
Thank you. And I think that some other members are going to join with maybe some delay because of train problems. I think that Jim Crocker from FASB is going to join us in a couple of minutes, and Mark Venus from BNP Paribas might also be a little bit late. Right. And we have, sorry, and we have to acknowledge that some people in Norwalk have woken up very, very early to join us by video. Good morning, Norwalk, or good night. I'm not sure what time it is exactly, but it still be night, apparently, on your side of the Atlantic. Okay, this morning we would like you to comment on the changes that were brought about by the new exposure draft as compared to the previous one. And not really to reopen too much of the basic questions. However, before we go into the points that we want to discuss this morning, maybe you would like to make a brief introductory comment on the basic assumption that will be a premise for our discussion, that all leases should be on balance sheet, either significant, and that lease contracts create assets and liabilities. I know that there are still some diverse views about this. Consensus is not yet fully there, although we see more and more support for this notion. Who wants to make a preliminary remark? We can spend a couple of minutes only on this topic, but if someone wants to say anything very important. Maybe Peter, if you want to start as a user.
I think we're all using to varying degrees. I think the first thing I would say is to commend the ISB, the FASB, the staff, Patrina and team, in the progress made over the past 3 years since the previous exposure draft. It's easy to look at the 3 years spent and say, oh my goodness, what have they been doing? That's been a long time. But I think the progress made and the improvements in this exposure draft over the previous one is noteworthy. So I'd like to say that first of all. As regards the overarching principle you describe, which is that leases give rise to assets and liabilities, and that all leases, you said significant, more than 12 months, should be on balance sheet. Yes, I would, as we always have at PwC, support that notion. There are certain things about the proposals that we're going to discuss this morning that I believe are a significant improvement over current accounting. There are some things that proposed changes where we are yet to be convinced the improvement is significant enough to warrant the change. But I repeat my opening remark that I would commend the progress that's been made.
Yes. That's
you agree? I'm sorry to go back, Philippe, to the basics. I think we have some issue even with the definition and the frontier between a service contract, lease, and executive contract, and so on. So in our business, it's we apply IFRIC 4 today. It's not so easy to apply IFRIC 4.
Can I, Pascal, sorry to interrupt. I think we will have time during the morning to discuss the scope.
Okay.
And the definition. So let's just address this basic point. Assume you have a contract and you have identified a lease. You know it's a lease, it's not service. Let's assume it's clear. And I understand that sometimes it can be difficult. But let's assume it's clear. I would say my question is, do you agree that that contract should create a liability and an asset to be put on the balance sheet? That's our starting point. And after that, yes, it can be difficult sometimes. Yes.
Yeah. If I may, yeah. Another comment is that we are lessor and lessee. And so I think the balance sheet or statement of financial position will be very difficult to be understood from the users because of the lessee as well lessee and lessor. Even if it's not, it could be even on the same kind of assets, on power plants, for example. So I don't know what will be the result of it.
Hello.
Thank you. I'd echo Peter's comments on commending the two boards and their staff for their perseverance with this project. I mean, very much like to see it brought to a conclusion in the fullness of time to deliver improvements to the current lease accounting model, where we think improvements are greatly needed. All that said, I'm afraid we answering your question, Philippe, I wouldn't say we don't agree that all leases result in assets and liabilities, but as we've followed the progress of the development of the right of use model, we've become more and more convinced actually that the right to use is not the appropriate unit of account, and not the current model, but the current distinction between a lease which transfers the underlying asset from the lessor to the lessee, or a lease that is fundamentally an executory contract, is the more appropriate cut. Now, one of the issues that raises is how should we be accounting, how should we be improving the information reported in financial statements about executory contracts, but we feel that a number of today's operating leases are not meaningfully distinguishable from other service and executory contracts, and the efforts to try and make that distinction are resulting in more and more complex definitional and applicational issues. So that is the context for a lot of our more detailed views on the ED.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you, Philippe. We, Deloitte, believe that the right of use model is an appropriate conceptual basis to address leases. Having said that, we do have some concerns, particularly in the areas around executory contracts or executory and executory contracts, in particular around intangible assets, and we think those issues have been identified in the revenue project. And have some concerns around those, and we remain concerned around the lessor side of the accounting.
Okay, thank you. I think we will have the opportunity to come back to those issues during the discussion. Anyone else wants to make some opening comments? Yes, Chad, user again.
Hi. So my starting position is, leases are complex, and I agree the boundary between services and leases is an issue. But current accounting is clearly broken, and I ended up supportive of the Dion balance. Although, you know, it does clearly compromises have been made in order to reduce cost and to reflect feedback that we've had from preparers in the main. But not all users of financial statements are financial analysts, and they rely on the recognition of the assets that management employ to deliver returns and visibility of the liabilities which must be met in order to understand the exposures the businesses run. And we'll talk about a lot of these things later on, but the one thing I would say is that, you know, the balance sheet does need to reflect the legal form of the contract, in my opinion, and the definition of a liability has been met. And most importantly, you know, management should arrive at their lease or buy decision purely based on the interests of shareholder returns and not a presentational outcome. And I think far too frequently that is the result.
Thank you. Well, I don't see any cards up for those opening remarks. So maybe, Patrina, now you can take us through the various discussion points.
Thank you, and good morning. Just before we get into the actual questions in the agenda, we thought it might be useful if I just spend about 5 minutes providing you with just an overview of sort of what we've heard from various outreach meetings so far. Those of you who know me will realise that keeping my comments to 5 minutes will be a struggle.
I managed to give you 5 minutes.
So I encourage you to obviously give me hints at any point when I yawn at the appropriate place or whatever may work. Okay, but I've certainly tried to keep it brief, and then most importantly, leave as much time as possible for you all to give us your views, which is the purpose of this round table. In terms of what we've been doing since May, since we published the exposure draft, we really have been trying to focus very much on costs and benefits. I imagine those two words will come up a lot at this morning's discussion. And obviously assessing costs and benefits of any proposals is fundamental for the boards, and that's where we've tried to focus the efforts. So in terms of, you know, what have we been doing and who have we been meeting, we focused first of all on the benefit side with trying to arrange and have as many meetings as possible with investors and analysts from around the world. And of course, in terms of costs, meet with as many preparers and on an individual basis to really try and get an in-depth understanding of costs. So first of all, in terms of investors and analysts, over the last number of months, we've had over 35 meetings now with more than 220 investors and analysts from around the world, Europe, the US, Hong Kong, Japan, Australasia, South Africa. That includes both the credit rating agencies, other credit analysts, lots of equity analysts, and covers both buy-side and sell-side analysts. The focus of those discussions were mainly on lessee accounting. And I suppose the overall assessment that we take from those meetings is that we do have broad support for the lessee accounting proposals from investors and analysts. I suppose following on from Jed's comments. Almost all of those that we spoke to believe that leases do create assets and liabilities for a lessee. And to reflect that, most are already making adjustments for operating leases today. Now, there are somewhat different views from equity analysts than credit analysts. And the views of equity analysts are more mixed than those we get from the credit analysts. Some of the equity analysts, when they make adjustments, are trying to get at the contractual commitments, the legal position of the lessee. And they pretty much wholeheartedly agree with our balance sheet proposals. However, some others would prefer to have a sort of whole life or whole asset information, particularly those who follow, you know, industry sectors where there is quite significant differences at an individual company level between owning and leasing assets. So the example is the airline industry, when obviously you can have some airlines that own almost all of their aircraft, others lease almost all of their aircraft. Some have told us that they would like to see, they are focused on the commitment side, on the liability side, But rather than being wanting to get at contractual commitments, they're more interested in getting at a sort of ongoing, perpetual commitments base, assuming that the company continues to operate on a similar basis. And from some, they're just concerned with any change to financial reporting. Some have mentioned that, of course, any change means there's potential disruption to some of their trend analysis, and they potentially have to relook at some of the models they use. And saying that, overall, so the majority of equity analysts support the proposals. They tell us that whilst they often focus very much on operating performance, which reflects their views, they also need to assess the risk of a company, and they agree the proposals provide much better information about the risk and essentially the leverage of the company. In terms of credit analysts, there's essentially unanimous support for the balance sheet proposals. They very much think that leases not only create assets and liabilities, but create debt-like liabilities. And they've told us that having a lessee's contractual commitments reported on the balance sheet, prepared on a consistent basis, would provide them with, would first of all improve financial reporting significantly, provide them obviously with much better information to use in their analysis, and ultimately reduce their costs. And we've also had support for the proposals from the credit rating agencies. Now, in terms of our meetings with preparers, in terms of costs, we have obviously had various meetings with groups of preparers, but also in terms of trying to get that in-depth understanding of costs, we focused on having what we're calling fieldwork meetings with individual lessees and lessors. And in fact, we've had some of those with some of you here today. The idea there, as I say, is to really try and get to quite an in-depth understanding of what individual companies, the processes they will have to go through to implement the proposals, and therefore obtain a much better understanding of what is really going to drive the cost, drive the complexity, so that the boards ultimately will hopefully be in a better position to really assess whether the costs of some particular aspects of the proposals might be more significant than the potential benefits from those proposals. What we've done is we've had, as I say, individual basis. We've gone to the company's premises, and the idea is there that we're not just meeting with the accounting people, but we've also met with the IT people, the people involved in writing the contracts on the business side, some people from the legal departments, from investor relations. So far we've had 14 individual fieldwork meetings, and that process is ongoing. There will be at least 11 to 12 further fieldwork meetings over the coming months. In terms of messages at those fieldwork meetings, I think at all of the meetings clearly there have been concerns raised about costs or complexity. Some are concerned about the dual approach to lessee accounting and the complexity that's added from having a dual approach. Some are concerned about determining the lease term, assessing significant economic incentive. Some concerns about the separating lease and non-lease components. Some concerns about the reassessment of variable lease payments or lease term. And some have asked for more guidance around the definition of a lease or what the boards mean by in substance fixed payments. I think overall the general message that we're getting from these meetings is that there could and should be some simplifications that could reduce the cost and complexity significantly. And of course some have mentioned ensuring that there's a sufficiently long implementation period. However, the overall message that we're getting is that from these fieldwork meetings is that the proposals are doable. Now, obviously, from this point forward, we expect and we will hear a lot more via the comment letters and obviously at this round table and at others. And that will obviously supplement what we've heard so far from the outreach meetings. So with that...
Thank you, Patrina. Any question to Patrina about this activity? Yes, please.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the... One on the credit rating agencies or the credit analysts in terms of the commitments, for example, you mentioned that they're interested in having the contractual commitments on balance sheet. Did they differentiate a little bit between what's really legally committed and maybe what's you know, just reasonably certain, or did you get into that much of detail with them, like what they're really trying to catch?
And I think your question, Norbert, is around, is it, you know, the non-cancelable period?
Are they just interested in what's really legally committed, or are they interested in more than that?
I think we did. We obviously, when we've talked to them, we very much focused. We didn't just ask, do you think leases should be on balance sheet or not? We very much went into the level of discussing the measurement proposals and how those proposals work. In terms of overall the change in measurement from the previous exposure draft, so the fact now that I suppose a large amount of the time we'd expect there would only be the non-cancellable, you know, lease term included on balance sheet. Of course, there would be optional periods included, but at a much higher threshold than the previous proposal, so only where there's a significant economic incentive. In general there, the investors and analysts are not concerned about that change. In fact, a lot of them are more supportive of that change because a lot of them expressed that they were concerned about the previous proposals in terms of the inherent sort of subjectivity in the estimates that might be included within those balance sheet amounts. So at least we've had general support there for the fact that they believe the balance sheet amounts now will be more reliable.
Okay, and in terms of the income statement presentation, you were just talking about the balance sheet. Did you get feedback on the income statement presentation as well? Because at least in our case, for example, I think it's probably true for others as well, that certain credit rating agencies give you credit for the interest expense portion once they adjust the amounts on balance sheet. So do you get any feedback on that?
We did. We obviously talked about, again, asked them questions about the balance sheet, asked them questions about the income statement. I think of the income statement, again, views are mixed. You're right to mention the credit rating agency, certainly the credit rating agencies, and some of the credit analysts, because they very clearly view the lease liabilities as being debt-like liabilities. Some of them, including credit rating agencies, would suggest that therefore there should be interest recognised in the income statement, corresponding interest amount. And a lot of them today adjust the income statement as well to separate out operating lease payments into depreciation and interest. So certainly some of those, including the credit rating agencies, might suggest there should be a single model that would always recognise, separate out interest in the income statement. Others have different views, particularly the analysts that follow specific industry sectors. So when we've spoken, for example, to the analysts that follow, like, the transport sector, the airline sector, those companies with very significant amounts of equipment leases, they're very clearly saying, yes, we support the proposals, there should be depreciation and interest separate. For those types of companies, we think it's essential that there's comparability between owned assets and leased assets in the income statement. For a lot of those analysts that follow the retail sector, restaurant sector, hotel sectors, they're quite supportive of the proposals. For those types of companies, they say it makes sense to us when we think economically about the retailer entering into the retail unit lease, that, you know, that continues to be sort of rent for use and continues to be an operating expense. In saying that, when you question it in more detail, and when we did question then some of those who follow, say, the retail sector about whether they had concerns about liabilities being increased, you know, an interest-bearing debt in some respects being increased without interest, some of them said no, that's not a concern for them because today they use EBITDA metrics and they expect to continue to use EBITDA metrics. In a sense, so meaning that their earnings measurement, they adjust the net debt, but when they look at an earnings metric, they will adjust for depreciation, amortization, interest, as well as rent expense.
Thanks.
Nice. And Jay?
Thank you, Philippe. Just to reflect back, I guess, on some of the comments that Russell Golden's made to the Wall Street Journal, he's focusing particularly on complexity, and I think you echoed on the importance the board places on cost-benefit analysis. It'd be interesting to hear your view and thoughts, really, around what feedback you've been getting on whether or not the current structure is truly broken and could it be fixed in a slightly different way, for example, greater enhanced disclosures rather than going down the various two types of lease, adding extra complexity, potential creep of extra subjectivity, and will that actually give the users that level of transparency which I understand the board's trying to pursue?
So, sorry, are you asking for more feedback on what we've heard from?
Right, you're getting mixed views from the stakeholders that you're meeting, particularly around the analysts. There seem to be two camps that you're sort of hearing. One supportive, others are saying not quite sure.
I mean, maybe just to make the message, I think what we're saying is from the 220 investors and analysts who heard, absolutely, we cannot say we've heard one single message from all of those 220. But the vast majority of those are certainly supportive of the proposals and believe it will improve financial reporting. Given the comments that I gave, particularly around what some of the equity analysts do, there are a few, relatively few of those that think, don't change the balance sheet, let's just improve disclosure. But at least what we're being told so far is that the vast majority do believe that a change is needed.
And maybe we heard that this morning from Jed and Peter, and that disclosures might not be the only answer to the issue. But sorry, I think Susan first.
Yeah, it was when you were giving us the feedback, you were saying that generally the lessee proposals were accepted. What about lessors?
Lessors, we've had, in terms of our experience, first of all, by the way, we're looking, you will have heard of the standard setters historically say we find it more difficult to, of course, access the analyst and investor community to get views, which is why, by the way, we've spent a lot of time trying to speak to them in outreach meetings, because, as you see represented here, we've only got one at this meeting, and when you look at the percentage of comment letters we get, of course, there will be relatively few from that community. In saying that, we made quite an effort, and we were able to access quite a lot of analyst investors interested in discussing lessee accounting. It's prevalent. You know, a lot of industry sectors have very significant amounts of leasing activities from a lessee perspective. It's more difficult, even again, to speak to analyst investors on the lessor side. With that being said, we certainly have spoken to some about lessor, and in fact we have another two or three meetings lined up over the next month to talk about lessor accounting. I think so far we're hearing, we've got mixed views on the lessor side, I suppose, and some of that depends on the particular lessors that they're following. We have spoken to a few analysts who follow lessors, more that follow, say, some of the larger sort of manufacturer lessors that follow car and truck lessors, where they have said that at least on the face of it, they think it looks sensible that we're sort of lining up more sale accounting with lease accounting from their perspective, because these types of, say, truck manufacturer lessors, when they come along, they're using leasing as a means of sort of selling. They'll either turn around and sell the trucks, or they might decide to lease the trucks. But essentially, for those lessors, it is like an extension of credit. In a sense, it's a means of selling their goods, but also providing credit. And therefore, our proposals make more sense, and of course, will provide more transparency about the residual. We have also spoken to some the lessors that follow some of those who have more of the longer-term assets. So we've spoken to some who follow, you know, the airline sector, drilling lessors, rail car lessors. And there they certainly are more doubts about whether they view the proposals as being an improvement over what they get today.
From my perspective is I'm involved in shipping. So we have 30-year assets. And interestingly, you didn't mention shipping, and it clearly is very important for us. So please, could you try, you know, I'm quite happy to talk to you, but I think looking at the shipping sector, which has very, very long-lived assets, should be a consideration for you.
Absolutely, and only to say, I suppose, that we would be only delighted that if you and others can get us access to more investors and analysts that follow, for instance, specific shipping lessors, we would be delighted.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take it. Reaction from the user, Jed.
I wasn't going to ask a question related to Katrine's presentation. I was actually going to try and clarify why I think she's getting conflicting views from the user community. Obviously, I'm look at accounting and valuation for Fidelity Worldwide, and that's both credit and equity. So I'm sort of interacting with both categories of people. In my first comments I made, that how important it was to see the legal form of the obligation on the balance sheet, that really is the view of the credit analysts in the main. The equity analysts tend to do other adjustments depending on the business. By far the majority of them are trying to reverse out to some sort of whole asset basis, recognizing that it's almost impossible to do that and put it all on the balance sheet, not least of all because there isn't a contractual obligation to deliver it. Because what the analysts, what most of our equity analysts are trying to do is to try and compare buy versus lease. That's the critical comparison. It isn't different leasing, one company leasing things on average for 6 years and one leasing on average for 7 years. We're not trying to make that adjustment. We're trying to do the buy versus lease. And what we're trying to understand is the legal form on the balance sheet, economic substance in the P&L. And we're looking at the businesses as a going concern, going on into perpetuity. What are the components of the lease payment? And as I see it, there's always three parts to a lease payment. One is the interest on the lessor's capital, and we try and work out what that is. Again, you can only really do that with the whole asset. One is effectively the cash charge for depreciation or repayment of principal. And the third is the cost of taking residual risk that's retained by the lessor instead of the lessee, and you get a different answer depending on different assets. In fact, the residual risk could well be a negative value for real estate businesses if you're bullish about real estate in the long term. So you get completely different components of that, and we need to try and analyse that, and that's why you get these different views. But even for equity analysts, sometimes they'll look at different things. So, for example, our retail analysts, so there's a lot of real estate in there. You know, at the moment, there are certain types of business that you think are imperiled by the internet, where you don't look at the whole asset for the properties they're occupying. You're actually absolutely focused on what are the contractual minimum obligations, because you've got to work out how they're going to get off the high street. And so the analyst is flipping between one and the other depending on the nature of the businesses they're looking at. So I think reflect the contractual obligations, disclosures, give us by nature of the asset and allow us to try and do the analysis that we're being paid to do.
Thank you, Jed. Michael, maybe are you talking as an investor, insurer investor, or as a lessee? Certainly not as a lessor, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Monahan, American Council of Life Insurers. The U.S. life insurance industry has $5.4 trillion U.S. dollars invested in the capital markets. So, yes, we are big investors. And that's why we're active participants in this and every project you see us here every month. I would like to commend both boards and staffs for their work on this project. We've come a long way from Sir David saying I could write a leasing standard in 2.5 paragraphs. That being said, I'd like to spend a little time sometime today on talking about presumptive type A leases. I don't think investors really care how many water coolers or copiers insurance companies carry on their balance sheet, and the cost and complexity of tracking those might be a little more than the boards wanted. In basis of conclusion 335, we say that we want to keep this a principle-based standard, but then on the type A, you lock it in at a year. So I'd like the boards to think about if a lease is incidental to your company's business, that maybe we should have a principle and not a bright line.
Yeah, thanks. But can I ask you to comment a little bit further on this point? As investors, big investors, do you think that maybe except for the smaller items, but for the large ticket items, we would like to see the items on the balance sheet of co-investees?
And I do apologize, that was the question. Yes, Petrina mentioned this morning that she mentioned airlines, and the U.S. Life insurance industry are big investors in airplanes, and our investors tell us that they want to see the significant leases on the balance sheets. As lessors, the aircraft has always been on our balance sheet, as you know. So we would like to see the big ticket items on the balance sheet.
Well, thanks a lot for your actions. I think that takes us directly into the first discussion topic, complexity, the dual model. What are your views on that? Maybe you can tee off this question.
Thank you. So with that, let's head into the questions in the agenda. If I go to page 3, and look, first of all, at topic 1. Topic 1, of course, addresses both lessee accounting and lessor accounting. In discussing this, I think it would be good. We're going to split these. We have 4 questions here, questions 1 to 4, but if we split this into 2 buckets, in a sense, for discussion, separating out the discussion and getting your views on the lessee accounting model, and then separately and afterwards talking about the lessor accounting model. So essentially, that first of all, we'll spend about 30 minutes, I hope, talking about essentially questions 1 and 2 in the paper. So looking at your views on lessee accounting. Are leases economically so different that there should be a dual model on the lessee side? And if so, what should that dual model be? And I think when you make your comments, obviously, what's most beneficial for us, if you could provide the reasons to support any of your views. So if we start there, spend about 30 minutes on lessee, and then we'll come back and talk about lessor.
We support all leases on balance sheet. Having said that, we have battled with understanding the split between type A and type B leases. And it seems to us that it is a somewhat arbitrary decision. We haven't seen enough to say property is so different from other long-term leases, ships, locomotives, wind farms, as were some examples, to distinguish between them. So we're not averse to saying there may be two different types. We're just not sure that the split as currently embodied is there, and having said that both of them should be on balance sheet, we have battled to try and find a split ourselves and haven't been come up with something that would make sense to us. So in terms of what our proposals are, we don't have any, but would not be averse to necessarily arriving at a split if it's done on a basis we can understand that has an underlying conceptual merit to it. So maybe it's time as a split, but then we think, you know, why property is not the only long-lived asset.
Yeah, and we heard from Jed that the residual value has quite different economics depending on the type of assets.
Yeah, but I think as was pointed out, some property leases may have consumption, others don't. It depends on where your view is of where property is going. So in terms of the entire consumption notice, not necessarily. It depends then on what the residual of that asset might be.
Peter, do you have a solution?
Pull the card down now. I wish. I'd echo a lot of what Trevor says there. It's I believe that not all leases are the same. We could all give different examples where I think leases lie along a very long continuum with the economics at both ends of the continuum vastly different, in my opinion. I know that the boards looked at a single model that might actually place leases along that continuum a little while ago, and it proved too complex to put into operation. So therefore, dividing leases in some way into the different types of accounting is something we would support. But the proposed model that bases itself on property versus non-property is a little bit of a blunt instrument. We can hear examples of how the economics of some equipment leases, and for those listening in, I just made speech marks with my fingers, actually have many similar economic traits to property leases. I'm sure Norbert can talk eloquently about telecoms towers, and I know in this room there's been debate about that before. Are they property? Are they equipment? Fibre optic cables, similarly, advertising holdings, the list goes on of things that you could be debating the nature of the asset to drive contractual commitments for reflection on our balance sheet, and that doesn't feel like a good place to be. Given that the boards are proposing a model which does lend itself to some degree to pragmatism, as soon as you start putting dividing lines into a model, that has to be a pragmatic place, because the world isn't broken up into boxes. So if we're in a realm of pragmatism and in an effort to as I think Andrew said earlier, conclude this project, which is something we would support, we actually would support retaining the dividing line as currently articulated in IS 17. It is not perfect, so before challenge, I know it's not perfect, but people are familiar with it. In practice, for property, it actually will be not too different from the model that's proposed, because the criteria for the practical expedient for property, broadly speaking, are those that are in IS 17, substantially all lease payments, major part of the life. So we're looking here at equipment, and whilst there may, at that dividing line, be some issues, it's an area that people are familiar with the accounting, and I think it would probably, and I'm taking a risk here in saying probably, gain more support than the dual dividing lines in the proposed model.
Yeah, although the proposals are not absolutely clear cut in a way, it is not absolutely equipment on one side and property on the other side. It is except if, and then we go back to this consumption notion.
Peter, I just wanted to ask, when you say, and I know you're only, it's only probably, you're only speculating it might gain more support, are you thinking more support from the preparer community as opposed to the investor and analyst community?
In the main, yes, but if you pick on particular sectors, and if they were to find out that telecoms towers are going to become equipment leases, I don't know. Jed's certainly more qualified to answer that question than I. I'm not sure that is the intuitive answer that they'd be looking for.
May I follow up on that just for a minute? I mean, both the key terms. Peter mentioned my name, but I like what Jed, for example, was mentioning. I think the terms you said, buy versus lease. You mentioned the word whole asset, and then I guess, depending on the situation, moving into maybe more, finding out what the contractual obligations are, depending on the nature of the asset, maybe that's what an analyst is ultimately looking for. And I think then, what Peter mentioned in our industry, obviously, you have a lot of assets that are, we deal a lot with portions of whole assets. And I feel maybe sort of even though I think the boards and IFRIC have looked into all these issues, to some extent, but I think it's maybe worthwhile exploring that into a little bit more and finding a good solution that is helpful for the users of financial statements. And at the same time, I think you can also draw a good conceptual approach out of that ultimately. And again, maybe just briefly making our position clear. We have 17.5 billion. Operating lease commitments in the footnote disclosure currently, and our analysts adjust the financial statements. So we're ultimately not so much concerned with putting things on balance sheet. It's more like having a conceptually sound basis. And is that 17.5 billion really the number that then a user is interested in? Because in our case, it is mainly driven. The main driver of that amount is the lease term. And that's why I asked earlier, is it really the legally committed lease term? Is it somewhere in between? What is an analyst user really looking for?
It would be interesting later on if you can tell us that maybe when we've done, how much is the adjustment they make out of the 17.5? How much is it, 7 times that, or 8 times, or 5 times?
No, actually, this is interesting. I think it's not. I don't know what the analysts do, or the credit rating agencies. They actually do a discounted cash flow model. So it's not the times. But I think if it were the times amount, I would also be less concerned, because then comparability is more there. Because if I, for example, make a judgment. This is really our biggest issue, I think Katrina and Jan know about this. We tend to be more conservative with our lease term compared to our competitors, and that's ultimately a competitive issue. So if it's not, if two objective decisions could be, they have in the U.S., for example, they have a 10-year lease term and we maybe have a 15-year lease term, then that 5-year additional amount in lease term is a huge, it's 5 to 6, 7, 8 billion in commitments. So that's where it's important to
to hone on.
Yeah, sorry, I was only going to say no, but maybe when we our next topic is talking about measurements, so definitely come back on that. But just to, before we move on, then just to get your views though then on LESI accounting and dual model.
Generally, I mean, we have a problem and issue with the income statement classification or presentation, which we don't really get. You know, it's we have no problem with having the you know, we're interested in one model, bring it on balance sheet, but having essentially, if you have a financial liability on the balance sheet, then that should be reflected in the income statement and cash flow statement as well.
You know, so you're saying you would want just have
interest
like
and amortization, and essentially even the one line expense is still interest and amortization. It's just amortization is derived in an unusual way.
David, you're next. I echo many of the views already expressed. Can accept sort of the dual model. My main concern is the inconsistencies between property and equipment, and between you set out a principle of insignificant consumption, and then have tests for property which are inconsistent with that principle. You know, where you've got substantially all major part. If you lease a building for the major part of its life, it's not going to be insignificant consumption by any stretch of the imagination. So sort of inconsistencies which is a problem. And once you've got principles and rules which are inconsistent with those principles, it's difficult to apply those other than just by leaving aside judgment and just applying the rules and nothing else. And therefore you end up with 90% tests and so forth. Also, there's inconsistencies between the accounting for type B, between the income statement and the balance sheet, i.e. got a financial liability with no interest expense disclosed, which is going to distort, I would have thought, the ratios and so forth. And the inconsistency between the lessee accounting and the lessor accounting for type B.
David, I'm hearing your concerns about type B accounting and your view inconsistency between the principle and the application, but what would your suggestion be in a sense, and do you agree with the consumption principle and not its application, or do you actually think there shouldn't be a dual model?
I think further look should be done at some of the other methods which were considered during the outreach, but they were, you know, like annuity depreciation and so forth, they were looked at very briefly. People were not given a lot of time to consider them in detail or understand them properly, and therefore were rather dismissed as being too complex. Whereas I think perhaps more time should be spent investigating methods which don't involve necessarily arbitrary classification rules.
Julian?
Yes, good morning. I'm going to respond with an unashamedly narrow focus. I'm not an accountant. I do deal with leases from a lessee perspective within General Motors in my role in real estate and also as chair of the RICS Corporate Occupier Group. The proposed accounting standards seem to the RICS to maintain a confusion of lease types between type A leases and type B leases. This seems to be based on an assumption that capital leases are effectively optional means by which to avoid buying a property. And this seems to misunderstand, as far as I'm concerned, the nature of property transactions in the market. And actually, taken with some of the other elements, rather than clarifying financial statements, it could lead to some businesses being disadvantaged in accounting terms and presentation terms, simply as an accident of geography. So, for example, if the primary asset is determined as being a building, with land as a secondary asset, and the building is totally written down in the context of a lease, that would appear to make it a type A lease rather than a type B lease, whereas in fact the residual value in some parts of the country would be a very considerable proportion, or maybe even higher at various stages of the lease than the buildings themselves. In other parts of the country, the land may be virtually worthless. So you kind of end up with a dysfunctional test depending on where you're based. And I'm not sure that's what this is intended to achieve. And I think, therefore, I think property should be in one category and treated in that way so that it's much easier to identify it and interpret it within the books.
So Sorry, just to clarify what you're telling us then, you are viewing property as different, but rather than having any property be, say, considered one or the other, you would just have all property.
I would treat it all in the same way.
Okay.
Mark, lessor, lessee, together, both?
Both believers, you know. No, I mean, I'd like to come back on the principle of distinguishing between leases. It's clear that leases, and I think this is something which everyone has now answered, go on a very long continuum. Either you find the Holy Grail and find one model that works for leases, whether they be at the service or the purchase end, or you have to have some form of classification. You've chosen a form of classification. I don't think the consumption principle is right. I think the consumption principle is actually a not very good proxy for is there a residual risk at the end, because I think that is actually the most important thing. By saying has the asset been significantly or insignificantly consumed, I think you're sort of halfway there. The real difference between leases, I think, and probably in the eyes of lessors and lessees, is at the end of the lease, who's got the risk, who's got both the upside and the downside. And so I think that is a better classification principle if you're going to have classification. And then it won't surprise you to hear me say that if you're going to classify leases, you also have to ask yourself the question whether you're classifying them for the purpose of measurement or for the purpose of recognition. And you know, the fact of being exposed to the residual risk, I think, is something very important in terms of defining what deserves to appear on a balance sheet as an asset. I know this goes back, you know, to the whole the founding of the project, in that the boards, I think, started saying we want to put all leases on balance sheet. I don't think that all leases deserve to go on balance sheet, and I think you've got them there because the definition that you have chosen to use of an asset is that it's a bundle of rights and obligations. But if some of the economic benefits flow, then it's an asset that goes on balance sheet. I think just saying some economic benefits flow without asking yourselves the question, is that significantly all, is there downside on the asset which doesn't flow, means that you automatically get to an answer where you say yes, it's an asset.
So assuming, and I know that you don't agree, but assuming that the model requires that leases be on balance sheet, is there a better way than going through the consumption and the indicators that we are proposing, that is the amount of payments, the useful life, the life of the lease, length of the lease compared to the useful life of the asset, or the total payments compared to the fair value of the asset? Is there a better way than those ones to measure this residual risk notion, in your view?
Well, it's a little bit unfair to ask me to give you the model.
Assuming and then distinguishing.
I don't agree with the basic assumption. But, I mean, it's been mentioned by David, who referred to it quite clearly. You know, a few years ago, quite a lot of people pointed out to you that there was a way of achieving straight-line P&L treatment with some conceptually consistent measurements involving depreciation and interest that involved taking maybe a brave decision on how you calculated depreciation for this new class of asset. The boards turned that down very rapidly and then proceeded to achieve the same result with a fix. Maybe take out the fix and go back and think again about depreciation methods. But that means going back 2 years in time. And I still think it... You know, I still think the project, you know, as time has gone on, it's become clearer to me, I think, in my thinking, that you've got to go back and say, what's an asset? What really deserves to go on the balance sheet? But the question of providing information to users is obviously there. To some extent, that's why we have disclosures, and they can be tidied up, improved, and so on. But as you said yourself, the user community does not agree on what it wants to see. Different users want different things. Some want the whole asset, some want contractual commitments, etc. So no one answer is going to please all the users. So you need to think about what's the most efficient way of getting the users the information they require and remaining in a conceptually consistent framework. And the fundamental question behind that for me is actually what's has now become, having thought about it more and more, what's an asset? What should be on the balance sheet? Not what do we want to put on the balance sheet?
We'll get back to you, Julian. I think Andrew first and then Simon.
Thank you. I think most of the comments I'd make have been made already, so I'll keep... Thank you. Keep mine relatively brief. I mean, of course, there are multiple different types of leases, and you can make as many cuts as you want to. But fundamentally, if the boards are going to implement a right-of-use model with conviction, then the model is that you have purchased the right to use the underlying asset, and there isn't really, as I see it, a strong conceptual foundation for the type A, type B distinction whatsoever. But I think talking about whether consumption is the right principle or whether it's conceptually well-founded isn't really the right question to ask. I see this all as a practical expedient. To have the distinction is a practical expedient to try and address concerns about front-loaded lease expenses. To have rebuttable presumptions for property and other than property leases is a further practical expedient. To fix the depreciation of the right of use assets to get a constant lease expense is a further practical expedient. So, I think again, asking about principles and concepts doesn't really get you too far. The question is the application actually clear? And I think subject to clarifying what we mean by property, and there are some issues there, but I wouldn't want to overplay them. I think they're hopefully within the wit of humankind to solve those issues as to what we mean by property. Integral assets that might be integral to the property should be fixable, but needs to be fixed. I think it's operational, and then the question really is whether the, if you like, the conceptual price to be paid is delivering commensurate benefits in terms of simplification and, quite frankly, palatability, acceptability to your constituents.
Simon.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge that the boards have addressed almost all the issues that in the comment letter we wrote on the 2010 ED. I think we would accept the arguments that have been made for the right of use model, but we should acknowledge also that implementing this project would be significant work for preparers, and anything we can do to simplify that while still achieving the objectives would be appreciated and worthwhile. Regarding the dual model, while there are perhaps differences between different types of leases, and even though Swiss Holdings has over 50 members, we don't necessarily have full exposure to all of the issues in the leasing industry. I mean, the one benefit from the 2010 proposals is that you had a single model and you would never be asked again to distinguish between finance and operating leases and have that classification decision. So when the boards decided to propose the dual model, I must admit personally to some dismay, and that's shared by a lot of our members, we are sceptical whether the differences between leases are so great as to require you to have the dual model with the extra costs and complexity that would impose on preparers. If you're going to have a single model, we think the type A lease is the one to go for. We have a particular problem with the amortization of the right of use asset under the type B model. It just doesn't feel right. You could say that if you have a very long lease of land, certainly in this country, the UK, there is some contracts where you pay for that up front in a lease premium, and you could say the amortization model of the type B that's in the ED would reflect some of the economics of that type of lease, but on the other hand, you know, the boards have rejected any idea of going for a sort of fair value model for or imposing a mandatory fair value measurement of subsequently for the right of use asset. So we think if you know, the boards do decide to have a dual model, there are better ways of achieving the straight line expense than what is currently proposed in the EED. Our comment letter does mention two. The first one might be acceptable where the time value of money is not material, and that is to not to discount the lease liability for the lessee, and you could then have a straight line amortization of the right of use asset, and that would achieve the straight line expense. The second is, you know, clearly a fix in the same way as the actual ED proposal has been described, because it involves straight lining both the asset and the sort of unwinding of the discount on the liability. And certainly from a conceptual point of view, there's not much I can say to support that, but we feel that the type B increasing depreciation of the right of use asset is also not the way to go.
Thanks. I think we have some questions from board members.
Just a question. You said one approach would be to not discount the liability. Do you have a conceptual basis for not doing that, or is it solely to achieve the straight line?
I think the basis for it would be to say that type B leases, where tend to be shorter probably than type A leases on the whole. So for many preparers, you might have a situation where you're looking at the difference between your undiscounted liability for the lease payments and your discounted liability, and you are coming to the view that the time value of money is not that material in relationship to your financial statements as a whole.
Do you think that's true in all interest rate environments?
I can't say that this will necessarily fit for all environments from a conceptual perspective, and it's only one of two suggestions we've made. I think Mark mentioned there was another proposal different from the proposal a couple of years ago. I must admit personally I can't recall that, but we could certainly look at other models, but it's really the amortization pattern for the right of use asset under type B that doesn't feel right to us.
But you will have a bigger liability on your balance sheet, and some will say it's too much. I think there is a trade-off between having a lower liability discounted and to have a charge in the P&L which is declining. So no one will be quite happy with your proposal, I think. Tom, as market regulators, what is the view of the market authority?
Thank you. As Asma, we understand that the dual model is a response to concerns expressed in the versus the 2010 ED. We could accept the dual model because it seems to result in more useful information for investors. However, we have some concerns, especially for the non-property equipment for making the distinction between type A and type B leases. We are not sure that the current guidance for making that decision is fully clear, especially notions like major parts and insignificant might create problems in the consistent application of this model, and also in the enforcement of the model. For that reason, we are not very unhappy by classifying property as a separate class, because the way it is the distinction between type A and type B leases there is made, we expect less enforcement problems. So that's what we see.
Thank you. Julian, is the burning remark and quick, because we're a bit late, so
yeah, it's just a very quick comment based on Mark's comment about assets and putting assets on the books. My reading of this is it's about calculating the liability, and the assumption is seems to be that the asset must be at least what the liability is, otherwise you wouldn't take the liability in the first place. And that brings up a question for me as a valuer as to why we're not really looking at the value of the liability at any stage during the leases, equivalent to the IAS 37 statement, which is effectively the present obligation as a result of past events where settlement is expected to result in an outflow of resources. I mean, that's kind of where those liabilities are at any stage. If it's a liability we're measuring, then I would think that we're unlikely to have the right liability on the books by simply averaging over a period of time.
Okay, thank you. Well, any remarks or questions from the board members or on the table?
Steve? Just on the last one, don't understand what you're asking for. Are you suggesting a current discount rate?
I'm just looking at the point where, from a layperson's perspective, I would expect the financial statements to tell me when it says that the company has a certain amount of liabilities, that those are the liabilities it has at a point in time. And I don't understand why you would understate liabilities potentially during the course of a lease by simply taking the liability at the beginning and straight lining it. Because what's happening is you're converting a liability into an asset and then treating the asset as a depreciable.
No, we're not straight lining the liability. That will be paid off as a normal liability, except it has a locked-in discount rate being the rate at inception. But we're not straight lining the liability. We're straight lining the expense, which is a different thing.
Katrina, can we move to the next question?
Not much to say other than to hand over to you to now flip your hat and take off the lessee hat and put on a lessor hat and ask you for your views on the lessor accounting proposals. Just to clarify again, the proposals are, of course, to have a similar distinction on the lessor side. That will create, I suppose, quite different accounting on the lessor side. For most real estate lessors, there will be very little change from today. So most of those real estate lessors would keep their property on the balance sheet. It would probably be investment property under IAS 40 and recognised rental income. For most equipment and vehicle lessors, they would treat almost all of their leases much closer to finance lease accounting today and separate out that receivable and residual. What the boards expected was that for the vast majority of the lessors out there, that would be a better reflection of how those lessors are actually pricing their contracts. But we'll hand over to you for your views on lessor account.
And I heard from some discussions with the French leasing industry that the operability of this model doesn't seem to be too problematic, but maybe Mark will want to confirm and get back to that. So who wants to start with this lessor model? I know that as lessees you may be less interested in what happens to the lessor, but some of you are both lessor and lessees. And Pascal said you are both a lessee and a lessor, so maybe you will want that. Maybe Susan first?
Yes. My first point, which I was wondering if it would be raised from the lessee side, but as I mentioned earlier, we have vessels, the company owns vessels, charters them out, the assets have a useful life of 30 years. And our original charters on our fleet range from 5 years to 17 years. So under the current proposal, those, in my view, would be type A leases. But at the end of those charters, depending on market conditions, we could either go into, I mean, our preference as a company would be to go in for another long-term charter, but in today's shipping environment we're going short-term, and then hopefully once that's finished we would then still with the same asset go into another long-term charter. And as a preparer and reading the proposal, it seems as if I would have one asset which over time would go from type A to type B and possibly back to type A again. Now, if we're trying to make life simpler, But it doesn't help me, and not my having to explain it to the end user. That just doesn't seem sensible, actually. I was just wondering what your views were on that, or whether I'd misinterpreted it.
Comment from the staff here, or Norwalk. By the way, Norwalk, if you want to intervene, please just.
I suppose I'd ask for your view on what you think would be an appropriate reflection of, you know, what you're doing in your leasing activities, you know, how you're setting up your business models. Are you constantly monitoring the residual value of the assets, etc.?
No. We do, for accounting, we obviously have to make an estimate, but what I have to look at is, at the end of the current charter, which could be 15, 18 years ahead, I am then having to look for what I think the charter rates on those vessels would be beyond the existing charter, and then take a view on the scrap value. I maybe will tweak it a little bit, but you know, when it comes down to it, is it significant, is it material, because it's so far ahead. So no.
Jan,
I'm joined the Petrina on a lot of these outreach activities, and I've heard this before.
What's the answer?
Well, that is very tricky to sit here and give an answer, but when we've discussed it, my answer was, and that is only a very personal view, is that it will, first of all, be very difficult for you to face up to investors and say that one third of my fleet is like this and two thirds of my fleet is like that and it's moving up and moving down. So the only solution I can see to that is then to say that we have some sort of a business model. Your basic model is to have short term, but temporarily you run into the switch over, and I see the problem. I think it's a real problem for quite a few companies. We have talked to retailers, for example, who have exactly the same situation where their shopping centers and things like that. And I think Petrina has up her sleeve at least an idea of a solution.
So are you saying that you're better off not doing anything from where you are today? I mean, you've got an asset and you've got a debt. I assume you finance.
We finance them. Okay. All our leases are on our balance sheet. Our revenue reflects actual charter received. So the performance of the vessel, I don't have to estimate 15 years ahead for off hire for a vessel. You've also got this element that I then have to split my revenue, my charter hire, into the lease receivable, but also then into a service contract, which again is accounted for now differently.
And I'm sorry, you said all your leases are on the balance sheet today.
Yeah.
What
all our vessels are on the balance sheet.
All your vessels are on the balance sheet at original price, original cost, less amortization.
Less amortization, less any impairment.
Okay. Well, in a way, you see your vessels as investment properties, type B, in a way.
Yeah.
In short.
Yeah. And you know, just to, if I, as you asked me, that really we disclose future revenue by maturity. We give a lot of information so you can actually identify each vessel, each charter rate, so you know exactly how every vessel is performing. And I think we have a lot of information. And the surprise that came for me trying to understand the rules is that what I think of as revenue, which is my charter hire that I physically receive as cash, that then just becomes a cash inflow. My revenue, my turnover line, of which my financial covenants under my credit facility are based, becomes a series of estimates, because it's the unwinding of the discount, mm-hmm. being the interest income on the lease receivable, interest income on the residual asset. And I actually find that quite a hard concept, that instead of actual physical revenue turnover cash, I've now got a series of estimates, and where these estimates may have been made sort of 15, 16 years before. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I've gone on.
No, sorry. Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Jay?
I think the earlier comment really echoes, going back to the conceptual framework, what's the perceived flaw that you're trying to address here with lessor accounting? And I think Petrina rightly sort of echoed at the beginning of the webcast that this area is a less of a concern. And I think when we speak to our members, the feedback we're getting back, overwhelming, they're already making the disclosure, the transparency is already on the balance sheet and the P&L. All this seems to be, really, from our perspective, is just adding cost and complexities without really addressing the original objective. And that's why I think perhaps if we go back to the conceptual framework, what are we trying to solve here? It's not very well understood and clear.
Maybe you or Mark, just to reply to that comment, and I'll ask or David, those of you who actually, of course, are lessors and are writing these contracts. I suppose part of this was obviously driven by thinking about, conceptually, what do we think the assets the lessor has after he enters into a lease, but also maybe thinking about, I suppose, a lot of those lessors that are writing, maybe like Mark, who are writing equipment leases, a lot of the, you know, vehicle leases, even the captives of the manufacturing companies, that at least our understanding is are whether they retain no residual risk, 5% residual asset risk, or possibly 20% residual asset risk, that they're pricing those contracts still in a very similar way. It's just obviously that they're retaining a bit more residual asset risk in some cases than in others, and therefore to have one model for accounting for all of those, whether they retain 5% residual asset risk or 20% residual asset risk, would be a better reflection of how those contracts are being priced, as opposed to having kind of a line today that means that some end up being accounted for under finance leases and other operating. But with that, maybe I'll ask the lessors to
comment. I would take Mark as a lessor view and then go back to the to Trevor.
At the moment, we have finance leases and operating leases, and there's a principles based distinction in IS17 which separates that out. Which reflects different business models of different types of lessor. It's true between us to say all lessors price the same way because they look at what the asset is worth at the beginning, what it's worth at the end, how long it's going to last, and then there's an interest rate and a margin. There's no other way of calculating a lease payment than that. But that doesn't mean that everyone's in the same line of business. Some people are in the line of business of taking on significant amounts of asset risk and trying to make the asset earn. And that asset could be property, it can be ships. Typically, I get the feeling that the reasoning in the shipping industry is, well, how do I generate a return on my wholly owned asset, which is completely my risk? That's basically an operating lease business model. And there are other lessors who will have a different attitude to risk and who will seek to limit their exposure to residual value risk, either by passing it on to the lessee or by going looking for coverage of their residual value exposure from third parties and more often that. And I would get away from 5%, 10%, 20%, or be very careful. It's not 5 or 10 or 20% of residual value that matters. That's irrelevant to the actual level of residual value. What really matters is the level of the residual value compared with the forecast market value at the time. That's the important number, which tells you whether you're writing a finance lease or an operating lease. Do you have real exposure to a risk both ways at the end of the lease? So, lessor account, there being two types of lessor accounting, doesn't shock me. What does shock me is when the lessor accounting is not consistent with the lessee accounting. And that's clearly become the case of type B. Type B is simply operating lease accounting for lessors and then something else on top of it for lessees. But you just can't fit the two together. You've got in the lessee's accounts, you've got the effect of a derecognition by the lessor of part of the asset, because the lessee is supposed to have acquired a significantly valuable asset, which is the right of use, and yet the lessor isn't even recognising the fact that he's estranged now from. The two don't hang together.
Yeah.
And so we can talk about lessee accounting, does it make sense, and talk about lessor accounting, does it make sense. You've then got to put the two together and see, do the two together make sense? And that's where there's the biggest problem with type B, aside from all the conceptual issues or consistency issues that we talked about in the lessee's accounts.
And sorry, just to clarify, can I take your comments there to say that from your perspective, then you think it's fundamental that lessee and lessor...
Yes, but be careful. They have to be... One has to be consistent or coherent with the other. Doesn't mean to say they have to be symmetrical. Doesn't mean that... If you take today's IS 17, it doesn't mean that if the lessor decides... he has a financial lease, that the lessee necessarily has a financial lease. And you've heard me say this before, because there are not just two parties to a lease. And I've repeated it n number of times. Notably in the equipment leasing business, there is very often a third party involved who's providing some form of residual value support, guarantee, buyback, recommercialization agreement, and so on. But the two have to be consistent. In other words, if the lessee is recognizing something, I would have thought that the lessor has got to de-recognize something. Otherwise, you're just creating assets out of thin air.
Is that symmetry or consistency?
Consistency. Because it could be someone else maybe recognizing something. The third party who's providing residual value support may need to be recognizing a risk she's just taken. So the three together may form, well, you can't do symmetry with three. Simplistic view of the world anyway, but the three together need to add up. Two, not necessarily, because you're ignoring them.
I think Trevor, you're next.
I need to start off with, we have not yet heard significant concerns expressed around the current lessor accounting. So we do not believe the issue is as strongly expressed as it was in the lessor for lessee accounting. In discussions with lessor preparers, I think, you know, I'd just like to echo Susan's comment. We haven't found equipment manufacturer, equipment lessors as opposed to property lessors who seem to understand and agree with the proposals. The property lessors seem very happy, and I think that's essentially because there's no real change for them. So they're not concerned, so they're quite happy. But the non-property lessors, I don't think understand the proposals. They don't know what they mean. I think, as Susan has been expressing, it's going to change the manner in which they report their performance, and they don't believe that performance reflects what they're actually doing. And I think to a large extent, it comes back to what Mark was saying around risk in the underlying asset. And a lot of those lessors take risk in the underlying asset. The asset is not consumed in the main through the initial leases. Ultimately, it may be at the last lease. And so what they're really doing is they're taking a risk in the underlying asset and reflecting that. And I think that might be why the property one on the lessor might work, because of the fair value nature of the underlying property, or the fact that the underlying property in general is fair valued, and that reflects the risk in the asset. Not necessarily proposing that all lessors should move to a fair value model on the residual. But I think that might be one of the concerns that's coming through, or the underlying concern is that the model doesn't reflect the fact that the asset has been used. They believe they are the owner of the asset. They take the risk in the asset. And I think that's what they're concerned about. The proposals, I think, are going to tend to mask that and turn, for them, it into what looks like a financing transaction. You know, if you go back to where IS 17 is, that tends to be reflected in finance or operating leases, that if you're a financing house and you're a lessor, it tends to be a financing transaction, is reflected as such, and that's appropriate for them. But if it's an operating lease, it reflects the fact that you retain the asset and you retain the risk of the future performance of that asset. And I think that's what these proposals might end up masking.
Thanks. Yes, I mean, I echo what Mark was saying about, I think there should be consistency between the lessor and lessee accounting, although not necessarily, you know, always classifying them the same and having, as he says, but I think treating one as a PP&E and the other as a liability that doesn't make
a lot of sense. I think also the type of accounting which a lessor wants often reflects the type of business model they have, whereas obviously Susan sees everything as a PP&E fixed asset. If you're a bank, on the other hand, you probably see most leases as being financial assets, and therefore the proposed accounting for Type A is obviously an improvement on the current accounting, because at least their interest income will much more closely map their interest costs and give them a sensible margin. So I think probably one solution might be to sort of look at it on a business model type case, instead of whether you are financial institution or another type of institution, and have a different model based on that, although then that doesn't fit easily with the consistency with the lessee, I have to say, because obviously they won't want to have different classification depending on the lessor's business model. But whilst I think the it's often said the current model isn't broken, and there have been a lot of complaints in the past from banks about the existing model and the basis that they make losses on operating leases in the early part of the lease. Most people probably now accepted that, and a lot of them can live with that, but what's been proposed is an improvement.
Thank you. Reaction from users, analysts, on this discussion about lessor accounting.
Generally speaking, I don't think you've had a lot of feedback from users, because I think they're relatively comfortable with the proposals. Having said that, they were also relatively comfortable with the old proposal. I think the key for them is just to understand it. My personal view is I think the Type A proposal is good, and the properties on the Type B also work. The feedback I've had where I really do struggle is exactly Susan's point, and I've heard it before, that there are these sort of three potential types. You've got a ship that you do for the vast majority of its life, and then it's in Type A. Then you do one that's relatively short term, say 2 years, and then it's Type B. And then you've got another one where you lease exchange it for 6 months and you don't do anything with it because you're less than 12 months. And it seems to me that having some sort of, this thing is rife with, practical expedience. It seems to me not unreasonable that, Susan wouldn't be allowed to account for all shipping lease contracts in the same way, and that even if it's less than 12 months, you still want to capitalise it. Because if you've got an accounting system that deals with all your lease terms, just because you've signed a lease for 11 months doesn't mean you should not capitalise it. We're saying because there's no incremental cost to you not to capitalise it. Whereas clearly, if the reason why we've got the 12 month is that if you're hiring a crane because you're doing a project in your factory for 3 months, yes, you don't need to put it on your balance sheet. There's a practical expedient there. But I think if you've got a business where the business model is to lease, then you should reflect.
In Susan's situation, the 6 months lease or the 2 years lease would be accounted for the same way, I suppose, because
it's less than 12 months.
No, you don't have... You are not required not to account for it. As a lessee, first, it is optional to not record. And as a lessor, I guess if you are in a Type B, the 12 months exception doesn't have any impact. Am I wrong?
Yeah, if it was a very short-term lease, it might be. But more a question I have for you, Gerritius, and by the way, thank you, Gerritius. From your perspective, thinking about it from analyst investor's perspective, how important is it for you that there would be somehow, what's the word, either consistency or coherency on the lessee and lessor side, or is that not particularly important to you?
Well, I've said before that my underlying preference is whole asset. And, I'd love to see complete symmetry on the whole asset basis, which is essentially Type A lessor accounting. I think if you've got absolute mirror image in lessee and lessor accounts on that model, I'd be more than happy.
So basically, de-recognizing one floor of a building would be sensible to you as well?
Or 20th of the ship?
Yeah, or, in my case, part of a tower, when you're a user and you're looking at that type of revenue that's getting generated, it seems...
No,
So I'm not.
I mean, the best thing to think of is.
I thought the whole asset was going to be on both people's balance sheets.
Yeah, but the lessor would basically, if you're leasing out a building and you're leasing out one floor of a building, if you have only type A accounting, then you would de-recognize a portion of that building for the sake of having that floor arriving at the lessee's balance sheet.
So I was intending for both of them to see the asset, which is the 100% of the value of the asset as a receivable on the lessor's accounts. You haven't de-recognized an asset. Your gross assets haven't shrunk. It's just that you've changed the nature of the asset from being something that is PP&E, that's a building, to something that's a receivable.
Yeah, but with all the IT costs involved, you know, you have to de-recognize your part of the fixed asset.
I didn't suggest that this should be adopted. and I was very clear earlier on. That I accept the fact that balance sheet needs to reflect legal form rather than economic substance. Right? What I said was, if I could have, you know, what am I trying to do, you know, when I'm looking at businesses as a going concern into pure perpetuity? I'm trying to look at lease versus own. I'm trying to look at the performance of the operations independent of any financing and independent of any presentational fudges that have taken place. And I think the only thing that, for me, that correctly reflects 100% of those economics is the whole asset. I was very clear saying, but I don't expect that to be the answer. I can see all sorts of issues with reflecting it in the accounting. But I was just specifically answering Petrina's question.
Yeah, and I suppose what I was just trying to get at is, so for example, at the moment, if you took a retailer and a real estate lessor from an analysis perspective, do you have any issues with the fact that on the retailer side, we're proposing that they would have, you know, based on contracts, a right of use asset, obviously not the whole asset, but right of use, but on the real estate lessor side, they probably keep the whole property on their books. Is that?
I'm absolutely comfortable with them keeping the whole property on their books. That's what they've got.
Okay, we are just about to break for coffee. I would take just one last and quick remark from Mark.
It was really just a reaction to what Jed was saying, because I understand the reasoning behind the whole asset model, but the problem what you say there is, once again, you're ignoring the exposure to the value of the asset. If you don't de-recognize and you say that the lessee has the whole asset on its balance sheet, I can understand you wanting to know that because you want to see if he's using it efficiently.
Yeah.
But there's something.
But hey, look, we've got lots of examples where we're saying we can solve this through disclosure, right? Mm-hmm. And what I would say is, if I saw on the fixed assets, here are all the airplanes I've got that I own, here are the airplanes that I've got that I lease, right? And this is the profile of when those leases roll off, and therefore, and this is the amount of residual value guarantee I've effectively got on these leased ones, whereas on the owned ones, I have 100% exposure to all the residual values. I'd be saying, okay, great, I can see that you're matching your risk profile appropriately. You've got some residual value exposure on your own, but you're making a higher return on it. You're giving away some return to the lessor on the other, but I can see that you've protected yourself. I mean, an example I had was, so I'm an airline opening up a new corridor, yep. Right? So I signed a 2-year lease because I say, look, within 2 years I'll know whether this is going to work, and then I can hand the plane back. I'll say, you know, that's, as a shareholder, I'll say that's a sensible analysis of the risk situation. You can hand the plane back. There's costs to buying and selling planes that you're avoiding, but you've effectively got that. That would be particularly relevant if I'm a small airline with relatively few of these. If I'm an airline and I'm buying 100 planes a year anyway, and I'm constantly opening and closing things, I'd be saying, well, do you really need to lease that for a 2-year period just to open up that one? You just allocate part of your fleet to that, give it a go, and why give up to the lessor the incremental return from providing you with that the dilution of your risk by provision of the residual value guarantee? And I'm saying you can get that answer by disclosure perfectly adequately.
Mm.
And all this issue around the assumptions you've got to make, you know, I've got to say I have relatively little sympathy to making assumptions. There's lots of assumptions in accounting. Look at fixed asset accounting. you've got to make an assumption about the residual value of the fixed asset. If you're amortizing it, and the amortization doesn't reflect the economic substance of the diminution in value of the fixed asset, we make a lot of back of an envelope assumptions in accounting that are broadly or materially correct, particularly if you've got a big enough book of business. And I don't see the leases any different.
Okay.
So we could just improve the disclosures and stay with IAS 17. I mean,
no. disclosure is no substitute for recognition. If you have a liability, you must recognise it. And I accept the fact that from a credit perspective and from many other perspectives, the legal form of the obligation, the contractual obligation, is the thing that should be on the balance sheet. It may not be the economic substance, but it is the obligation that you cannot get out of. And so when I'm thinking about a business not as a general concern, but as a balance of assets and liabilities, then I absolutely I'm comfortable that the liability doesn't mean that that's how I'm going to analyse it.
Gentlemen, I think I'm going to cut the discussion at this point. It was absolutely exciting, wonderful, but I think we deserve a coffee break. So please be back exactly in 15 minutes' time at 10:50. Okay, you are on air again, so we will resume. I think we are done with the dual model. Well, done. We have had comments from you. Now we will move on to complexity and measurement issues, and we'd like to hear your views about what could be done to ease the measurement of lease contracts. Maybe Patrina, you want to tee off this question?
Yes, very quickly. So we'll move to topic 2 in the agenda. It's questions 5 through to 8. Just to say that in getting your comments on measurement, we split the questions out because it would be interesting to get your views separately on those 3 different measurement pieces in a sense that we've identified. First of all, any views you have on lease term and determining the lease term. Your views around the inclusion or not inclusion of variable lease payments within the lease assets and liabilities. And thirdly, around discount rate, because obviously this is the measurement, particularly on the lessee side, is obviously a discounted measurement. So how you come up with the discount rate is pretty fundamental to the measurement. And again, in commenting on whichever one of those 3 areas is relevant to you, also useful if you maybe separately tell us about your thoughts on the initial measurement when you first enter into the contract versus any sort of reassessment. And if you have any different views about whether it's appropriate or not at initial measurement versus reassessment.
Okay, who wants to start? Simon?
Yeah. We agree that the lease term cannot include only the minimum non-cancellable period. The proposals on options with a significant economic incentive, at the moment, we understand the boards regard this as sort of threshold is similar to the reasonably certain threshold in IS 17, but that's not explicit in the text of the ED, and we believe it would be useful if that was put into, or a threshold was put into the ED. We were talking here about putting into the lease liability of the lessee and the lease receivable of the lessor amounts that are not guaranteed to happen, which the lessee can avoid. That creates some tension with the requirements of the similar items in other IFRSs, and we think that as well as the economic incentive being shown to exist, it is necessary to consider the probability, and that should be a very high threshold. We also know a lot of people are saying, well, the lessor won't necessarily know whether the lessee has, you know, is going to exercise that option because of the economic incentive. And we think if the threshold is extremely high, then that's probably something that will be clear to everyone, including the lessor, as part of, you know, when the lease is negotiated, and so that will solve that particular issue. Reasonably certain, we believe, is the right sort of threshold. Alternatively, virtually certain could be used because it will tie in with the existing IAS 37 requirements for contingent assets. We think that will reduce a lot of the uncertainty and the possible inconsistency that could come out of applying or making the judgments on this aspect of the proposals.
And you think that virtually certain would be assessed in the same way by the lessee and the lessor, because you talked about the information asymmetry, about the incentive, but what about reasonably certain?
It's, of course, subjective to a certain extent whenever you use words like reasonably certain, virtually certain. But establishing a particularly high threshold, we believe, will result in more consistency than leaving the threshold out of the actual text.
David?
Well, first of all, I welcome the changes from the original ED in terms of the definition of the lease term. I think reasonably certain has always worked quite well, and I suspect the new definition will work equally well going forward once people understood, and probably won't create a huge difference anyway. Do you want comments on the other things as well at the same time now?
Sure.
My main concern probably is more with the remeasurement of variable lease payments. I think there are practical difficulties in what has been proposed. For example, the ED accepts the fact that a lessee may have insufficient information in order to calculate the rate implicit in the lease, and therefore allows the lessee to use the borrowing rate. And yet the ED expects the lessee to have sufficient information to be able to recalculate those lease payments following an interest rate change. And that seems inconsistent, because you need exactly the same amount of information. If you can't even calculate the rate implicit in the lease, how can you recalculate the lease payments? There's an inconsistency there. And I think, in practice, it'd be very difficult for a lessee to recalculate the lease payments for changes in interest rates without knowing the lessor's cash flows and having the all that information on its systems.
So what would you suggest?
I think keep the basis we have at the moment, which is you recognise the variation in lease interest payments as they arise. It's worked well in the past. I'm not sure if additional information of re-grossing up the balance sheet adds a great deal. It's just a lot of complexity. And on a discount rate, again, I think more flexibility is required. It says one has, it's very prescriptive in when you can change the discount rate. But if, for example, you have a tax variable lease where the rate implicit in the lease was originally affected by tax, and those tax assumptions change, then I would have thought the discount rate should change. My reading of it probably wouldn't allow you to do so. So again, I think more flexibility. But I think generally, the problem with the ED at the moment is very prescriptive in some areas, yet gives very little guidance on how you actually do it. Either you should explain how you deals with tax variations and interest variations and so forth, or be less prescriptive and leave it to the preparers to come up with practical solutions.
Robert,
Yes, so our position is, with respect to the lease term, is that it definitely needs to be improved. There should be an improvement in the lease term because, especially with respect to the optional extension periods, it's our observation, and you could maybe do some research on that, that at least between IFRS preparers and US GAAP preparers, there is a difference. You know, I think I would say that probably US GAAP preparers, certainly in our industry and maybe with other industries, do include not only the non-cancelable period, but also really seriously consider extension periods. Whereas I believe that perhaps here in Europe, you know, people default rather to the minimum, you know, the non-cancelable term. And I think when companies then come forward and say we're happy with the reasonably assured, reasonably certain threshold, what they really mean to say is we're happy with just the non-cancelable initial period. At least it's something that I would suggest that you explore some more.
And what is your reaction to the economic incentives being used as a threshold for recognizing variable payments?
Well, so having said all that, is I think the position ultimately is, you know, if, I think in the basis of conclusions, and people have said this in public, that you, I guess the view is that reasonably certain is a high threshold today, and if that's really what you meant to say in the standard, you should say that. And I guess what we were proposing only helps to a certain extent. Maybe there's a rebuttable presumption that only the non-cancelable lease period is supposed to be included, whatever. But I think the, from our industry perspective, I would say generally, the new notion with the significant economic incentive, it's hard probably to apply, but works, you know, can work. But at the same time, conceptually, our company would also say, similar to what Mark was mentioning earlier, that, you know, it's really, if it's not committed legally, it's not a liability. But in, for the sake of comparability, I think there ought to be some more guidance, what's reasonably certain, reasonably assured, or whatever you call it.
Julian?
Thank you. On the question of lessor versus lessee, I think that it's quite possible that there would be a difference in value between the two. I think the termination option, a lessor would value a risk, whereas a lessee would value a likelihood, and I think those may very well differ. So don't be surprised if those are different. One of the challenges for lease term that some of our members have thrown up are things like, for example, if you've got British Airways with 6 months rolling agreements on check-in desks in Terminal 5 at Heathrow, you'd kind of assume that because it's a BA terminal, that they're going to maintain those checkout desks, but they tend to be on rolling agreements. And I'm not quite sure how those get picked up as it is here.
Well, do you think there is a significant economic incentive to stay in this terminal?
I think that's probably right, but I mean, in terms of how you measure those in the context of lease accounting is not clear to me anyway. The one point that I want to make, and this may not be the right time for it per se, but I think it is relevant here, and that is that within real estate leases there are leasehold improvements and asset retirement obligations, and I think that both of those should actually be encapsulated within the lease accounting and should be composite. But in terms of determining the term, it may well be that the process that the lessee uses to determine the period of time over which it's going to depreciate its leasehold improvements or accrete its asset retirement obligations may well determine where it thinks the term is.
Yeah, we would expect some consistency in the decision on the estimates being made.
I think if you account for those as a composite, then it's very clear what they should do. If you separate those line items out.
Even if separated, there is a general principle that estimates made in accounting should be mutually consistent in a way. That is a general principle, I guess. Peter?
Echo what some others have said, or at least one other person has said, that the positions on both lease term and variable rents in the current ED we see as a substantial improvement on the 2010 ED. And the broad principle of what the board's trying to achieve there we would support. A couple of points of detail on the significant economic incentive where the boards do acknowledge in the basis for conclusions, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, but broadly speaking it means the same as reasonably certain. If it means the same as reasonably certain, why not call it reasonably certain? which is a phrase people are familiar with. We already have so many recognition criteria, reasonably certain, virtually certain, probable, etc. I could go on. Introducing a new one doesn't seem very timely at the moment. There's also, of course, the parallel debate that the ISB is having on its conceptual framework, and I know there will undoubtedly be a debate around economic compulsion versus significant economic incentive versus constructive obligation, and to the person in the street they sound very similar, but the way they're likely to be defined could well take account in a different direction. So I think it's something to be mindful of there, that the recognition criteria for assets and liabilities are starting to creep differently into different standards. As regards variable payments, I agree with David that the need to reassess potentially quarterly could well be onerous for many businesses. Whether there is something to explore regarding the frequency with which leases are repriced, because it may well be that whilst rents are variable, they're only actually repriced on an annual basis depending on the index on a particular anniversary. So there may well be some kind of relief for interim reporting that could be explored there. Finally, back on the subject of consistency, I think I just urge the boards to be mindful of consistency, particularly for lessors as the revenue project is finalised. Significant economic incentive is a phrase that does appear in the revenue ED, and whereas in the leases ED, various factors for identifying significant economic incentive are laid out, in the revenue ED we have a statement that if you have this factor, it is, or there is, an economic incentive, which is, I think, taking a contrary position to what the leases ED might explain. So be mindful of that.
Okay, to my right, Andrew, I think you're next.
Thank you. In the context of the right of use model, we think the decisions made on lease term and variable payments make sense. I think a significant economic incentive is more objective than reasonably assured or reasonably certain, gets away from past practice and management intent driven factors, which we would support. On variable payments within this model, then we need to avoid recognising payments that aren't liabilities at the measurement date. So I think it makes sense to exclude usage or performance based payments, which would probably be broadly within the control of the lessee. Peter mentioned consistency with revenue recognition in the context of economic incentives. The difference in the thinking about contingent payments between revenue and leasing is also noteworthy. I think in if we were to move to a transfer of the underlying asset type model, as we suggest, I think we probably could get at least more consistent with revenue recognition in the context of the right of use model, then some inconsistency seems to be necessary, because ultimately I think the revenue recognition thinking is driven more by not over-recognising revenue that might be reversed in future periods, and this thinking is about not under-recognising liabilities, so it's kind of hard to reconcile those two objectives.
On the significant economic incentive, and I would also like then Trevor to comment on this one, do you think you have a reasonable objective basis for auditing the estimate with this criteria as opposed to some other possible measurement? Maybe Andrew,
An objective basis for auditing the lease term.
Yes.
Well, of the various difficult accounting and audit judgments that have to be made, I wouldn't put that as all that high on the list. I think, if anything, because it is more objective, it should be somewhat more straightforward. I'll borrow Peter's inverted commas for those on audio. Somewhat more straightforward compared to auditing reasonably assured or reasonably certain would be a first. I haven't personally signed an audit report for about 10 years, so I might not be the right guy to ask.
We would, I think, much the same as Peter's mentioned, be more comfortable with the term reasonably certain for the reasons mentioned. And from the auditing perspective, that is what we have been looking at for a while. So, much like Andrew, I haven't done the auditing for a while, but my colleagues seem to be signing off on those, so I am assuming they are doing it and looking at it properly now, and they'll continue to do so in the future. So I wouldn't be overly concerned about the auditing side of it, and particularly if it's a term that people are comfortable with, so reasonably certain from the ISB's point of view, reasonably assured in the US. So, you know, other than that, we would be comfortable with the lease term. We would, however, and continue to believe that it would be helpful to recognize an option in respect of any additional potential lease periods. We agree, as was mentioned in the discussion paper, that the fair value is quite difficult to determine, but we think it would not be, you know, too amiss to recognize the intrinsic value of those additional periods. The time value is the difference, and it would have been amortized in any event. So we don't think that's a step too far. So that would be the one proposal we'd make around lease term that we think the board should consider.
How would you measure this intrinsic value then?
The intrinsic would be the difference between current, what you would be able to renew at, and what the market, where the market would be.
And so would you require constant remeasurement of
that? Value of the intrinsic value, yes. We would be excluding the time value. Anyway.
And then you would have a corresponding liability moving in parallel to this.
This would probably be an asset on the lessee side, you would hope, and a liability on the lessor side.
Okay, but would the lessee recognize what is the contra entry for the lessee? It would have an asset moving up and down, and would have an income statement. Yeah.
It would be a gain that they've made through the passing of or signing of that contract, and the gain would arise over time as rates move. On the variable payments, the only comment we have different to the ED would be on performance. We think not sufficient work has been done in general on contingencies based on performance, and at this stage we would propose requiring disclosure but not measurement until the boards have considered how to deal with contingencies based on performance in general on all assets, and once a solution has been obtained or how to deal with those contingencies, bringing it back into leasing proposals.
Thank you. Regarding the variable lease payments, we think they should be taken into account. However, we would like to encourage the board to clarify how to determine whether variable lease payments are in substance fixed payments. This is an issue that is not that clear for us, and examples was not given that we think it's not sufficient for consistent application and for enforcement. Regarding the lease term, in the basis for conclusions 107 till 110, the ISB assumes there is no economic incentive for lessees to agree to contracts where the term of the lease is open until further notice. What we understood is that there are some jurisdictions, for example in Finland, where those contracts are common, and there is a practice of these contracts, and when you read the basis for conclusions, then the board thinks that there is no economic incentive for that. But when you have such a contract, and you have a factory, and you rent it on this basis, there is an economic incentive to go on with it, because it's very expensive to move your factory. So we would like to ask the board to pay attention to these type of contracts, because we think they should be included as a liability and as an asset in the balance sheet because of the significant economic reasons to go on with the lease contract.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just to make sure I understand. So if you have a variable lease payment that is dependent on, say, achieving a certain level of sales, and you pay an additional percent, you would support including that as part of the lease payment or making an estimate of that?
When you say your lease is fully based on sales,
fully based on sales.
Fully based on the sales. Mm-hmm. Then we think that the economic substance of the contract is that you have to pay a certain amount, and you have to make an estimate.
So that would avoid structuring of deals. What if it's 10%?
Yeah.
What if the variable payment is 10% and goes out 20 years?
Yeah, that's that's a funny question, because then you are now trying to tell me where the distinction should be made.
Right.
And
that little detail,
yeah. To be honest, I don't know.
I was hoping to start. Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Charlie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Monahan, American Council of Life Insurance. We are in a unique position with $5.4 trillion invested in the capital markets. We are both lessors and lessees. We are users and preparers. Regarding the lease term, we agree that if there is a significant change in the relevant factors, the lease term should be reassessed. However, in addressing the reassessment of options in the basis of conclusions 171, and I'll read so I don't have to paraphrase, an entity should be required to remeasure lease assets and lease liabilities as a result of changes relating to options relatively infrequently, thus reducing costs associated with reassessment. We would like to suggest that the boards explicitly incorporate this in the lease term discussions within the body of the final standard. This placement will provide more clarity and will help us as preparers and in working with our auditors. Thank you.
Then, Andrew. Airline industry.
Pardon?
Airlines.
I think I wanted just to broaden out a little bit the concepts we've been discussing about the use of language and the importance of choosing terminology that resonates with the various communities. And I think the one particularly I wanted to draw attention to is the one about estimating the discount rate and whether or not it is readily determined, which to my mind sounds quite a high threshold. And as soon as you put into that any kind of serious estimate, I question whether it is genuinely readily determined. So if I look at this from the perspective of ourselves as aircraft lessees, in order to estimate a discount rate, we have to estimate a residual value. Because it's very, very uncommon that a lessor, not unknown, but very uncommon for a lessor to tell us what their RV assumption is. So in most cases, if you intend readily determined to be quite a high test, we would have to say, actually, we can't readily determine. Personally, I think it's another area where if you just soften the language slightly, something like capable of being reasonably estimated, then we're in a place where preparers, auditors can have a genuine conversation about what's reasonable, as opposed to a conversation about what's readily.
Thank you. Right, have we covered sufficiently this first series of questions, I think? So let's move on to 9 to 11. That's enough.
Yeah, and just it's good. The clock is very deliberately right in front of Philippe and I, so we're aware that we now in the next 48 minutes want to cover scope and then obviously any other issues. So keep moving. In terms of topic three and scope, we've identified two topics we're interested in your views in. The first, of course, is the definition of a lease and how you determine whether a contract contains a lease or is a service contract. And the second is then, having determined that a contract does contain a lease, there are obviously some proposals around separating out the amount being paid for the lease component separately from anything being paid from service components. So again, over to you for any views that you have on those two aspects of the proposal.
Okay, who wants to come first? Peter.
At a broad level,
I think that the principles for defining whether an arrangement contains a lease in the ED are an improvement on the current guidance in IFRIC 4. I think aligning at the principle level identification of a lease with some of the principles in the consolidation standard and as that being debated in the revenue project is a sensible place to be. And if we stopped there, I think I'd be a happy man. But then we stray into the examples. And sadly, as soon as examples go into a standard, then people play example match. And I have spent more time in the past few months talking about coffee machines than I consider healthy.
Well, it's good to do that.
The coffee machine and medical equipment examples are prompting a lot of people on the one hand to say, but surely they're both leases, and on the other hand, surely neither of them are leases. For the first example, it's prompted a real debate around substitution rights, which appear to be considered from the lessor perspective or the supplier perspective, not so much from the purchaser stroke lessee perspective, and we would consider that both sides are important. For the power purchase agreement examples, we've ended up really getting into the detail about, okay, what does involvement in design mean? Because consolidation standard would appear to take you one way, but these examples appear to take you somewhere completely different. So I think we have some concerns about the examples. Luckily, we're talking about examples here, and I'm sure illustrative examples can be worked upon, but at the principles level, we would support where the boards are going.
Can I just ask in your comments, do you think there is sufficient wording then in terms of principles and guidance then, and we just remove all the examples for people to get there?
There are lots of great things in the world that I'd love to believe in, one of which is that you can write standards based solely on the principles and stop there and hope people will do the right thing. Most people will do the right thing, but there remains in the current environment a need to provide additional guidance and illustrative examples. I think we're not yet in the position where we can just disregard those.
No, a view from the energy companies, and Pascal, please try not to take us into the details of your contract.
No, but, I'm not going to talk about coffee machines or airplanes, but about maybe on the power purchase agreements, the energy business. So we apply IFRIC 4 and we have a lot of questions regarding the scope or the definition of a lease. So we have examples and so on. So we try to work, even if the ED was in the middle of summer, so it was quite difficult to have people together to speak about this ED. But you go from one company to another company, one operating in Mexico, another one in the Middle East, and so on. The contracts are different, the clients are different, the environment are different, and you end up with different interpretation: is it in the scope or not in the scope? So
I think you're saying, based on the words of what's in the ED, there isn't sufficient guidance there, at least for your industry sector, to get to consistency.
What we do today is that we first focus on the financial risk, not on the operating risk. Because for the energy business, if, for example, a steel company has a take-or-pay contract, they are not able to operate the energy power plant. But they could take the risk. So for us, the risk is key on the analysis. So today, with your definition and examples, so one will take I cannot operate or I operate, or and you also have some contracts with, I would say, we are not sure of the scope, IFRIC 4, IFRIC 12, so you have a regulator, grantor, state company, not because we operate some energy plants in, I mentioned Mexico, South America, or even Middle East, or even in Europe, the markets are different. So that's why it's very difficult to end up with, I think consistent application will be a challenge among you preparers, because we don't have, even if, for us it's not a question of having more debt, because we have these assets on the balance sheet, so it's not a question of increasing liability, it's only a question of presentation and to have the users understand the business and the cash flows, because the risk for us are really different. If we take the demand risk, if we take the price risk, if we take the fuel risk, the risks are really different, and we have the asset on balance sheet. So for us it's very important to have this information. But I would say for preparers, we are from maybe the steel company industry. They don't want to have these leases on the balance sheet. So I think it's maybe it's a challenge, and it's very difficult to have one voice from the industry because the objectives are not the same. And today, as these contracts are leases, even if they are operating leases, we have to provide with some information. If they are not in the scope, no more information in the disclosures, because today, I think we don't have to give any information on the executory contracts, on the take-up contracts, or even on the, I will not mix up everybody, I will not talk about financial instruments, but even on the own-use contracts. So I think we really have a challenge about the definition, but it's a challenge. It's very difficult.
And just if I just take one view, because without going into more detail, I think one thing I hear coming across is you'd recommend that we build in a bit more, perhaps around looking at risk, yeah. Even if you're assessing control.
Then what we do, we assess risk. We focus on risk, not on operation and on control, on risk.
And
risk and rewards.
It's mostly financial risk. So the indicator of a lease contract in those situations would be, do I have a financial risk?
Residual value, demand risk, fuel risk, and so on. So.
Okay, another preparer view, Suzanne?
I just wanted to come to answer about the separation of the into lease and non-lease components. For us, and the wording at the moment is that, you know, one of the elements, there should be an observable standalone comparison. Now, I've been asking around, and I, for the two elements for us, which is the lease receivable and then the management of the vessels, it's very difficult to find anything that will could be viewed or interpreted or accepted by that definition. So I would be back to looking at maybe track records of vessels if it's one that we've been operating for a while, or having to, but everything again would be estimates all the way through. So I have concerns about doing that, and again in the context of very long charters, very long leases. I think you asked me then, you know, what else would we do? And the options seem to be, well, either we don't split it, we just keep the components together, or somehow we would have to change the threshold. But that still doesn't get away from one of my concerns, which is that everything will be based on estimates. So I'm afraid I can't really help you on that.
And I think to clarify, from as a lessor perspective, we send you in splitting to the revenue proposals that would say, you know, you obviously start with getting observable prices, but you can use estimates from your perspective. What might be the issue is your customers, the lessees, are being asked to split out lease service as well based on the observable prices, so potentially you will be asked for more information from your lessee side. So as a lessor, you can use estimates in terms of coming up with a split, but from the lessee side.
But I think generally this, the concept both also for discount rates, if you look to see what your lessee is paying and everything, I think this, it's an ideal situation that both sides share information, and I don't think we always do.
Just a quick question. It's been 30 years since I've done ship accounting, but I recall a lot of estimation processes surrounding surveys and the repairs that would be done ship once they were brought in to dry dock and everything. How do these estimates differ from those that are developed for estimating repairs over time?
I think we would have to exclude dry dock because, as I understand it, a vessel is, well, the vessel always has the two components. You've got the hull, but you've also got the dry dock asset. And the dry dock asset will stay on balance sheet. So any costs associated with the dry dock will still be dealt with as currently. You get the question, though, of dry dock as it relates to your revenue and the lease receivable.
My point is, it's all one big estimate anyway, and so this is, well, why is this one different? Because you were emphasizing the degree of estimation.
Because I can roughly guess what we know clearly what our estimated costs will be for the fleet going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Where I have concerns is that we then have to split it so that I then show my lease receivable, and the interest income on that is actually quite important. But the more I take out for the costs of the vessels in doing that split, and most, I think, maintenance of most assets increases over time. So do I have... It just gets incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's still the same actual cost, but it's showing how the lease receivable is affected and then my service contract is dealt with. And if I keep more in effect to cover my service contract, then my lease receivable is smaller, which means it looks like we don't know what we're doing somehow. It's almost playing with numbers.
Okay.
Estimate upon estimate. And I mean, the one thing that we do know is the revenue figure, which is now moves to really cash flow.
It's not so much you can't do it, it's just what is the meaning of estimate upon estimate upon estimate.
And okay, then when or if these estimates are then trued up.
Mm-hmm. Which will be every quarter.
Even on the lease receivable? Yeah, I don't. Okay. Sorry.
I think I will continue with preparers' views. Simon, maybe?
Very quick and specific point. We have a number of embedded finance lease assets that we've recognised under IFRIC 4, which we believe will fall out of recognition under the new definition and scope proposals. It would be very helpful if we could have some sort of modified transition method for that. We think the costs of doing a full retrospective back out of that are greatly going to exceed any benefits for users.
Norbert, another good overview.
This is regarding the set-top boxes that we have that we market, and think in terms of a pre-programmed coded set-top boxes only works with our service. And you know, there is this little paragraph in ED 19A when that refers to when something is sold separately by the supplier or other suppliers. We seem to have an issue with that because it seems like the board, in the basis of conclusions, intended, that's our reading at least, so if the customer does not have the ability to influence the economic benefits derived from the hardware, so in this case, you know, it's clear that the person that uses the IPTV set-top box does not have any independent ability to use that set-top box other than with our service. That in the basis of conclusion, it seems to say that the board's intended to exclude those set-top boxes from leasing, versus then when we come across this paragraph 19A, where something is indeed sold, maybe on a secondary market through eBay and so forth, because somebody had already bought the or leased it and somehow got a handle on a set-top box and then sells it in a secondary market, then it again may reverse the judgment on whether you have a lease or not. So we suggest that this should be clarified somehow. I think that's the main point I want to make.
Thank you. I will continue with preparers, maybe Andrew Tempest.
I just wanted to briefly mention at this point the perennial topic of wet leases, which have four components, of which only one is a lease. And just to observe that these are priced as a single unit, and there would be extreme difficulties in trying to observe standalone prices, not least the last time we did one of these, for any length of time we were using a Finnish aircraft, and we have no view on what crew cost in Finland. I think the point I really wanted to make was that in a wet lease, as it's normally defined, there is no substitution right. You buy the package of the four units, Indeed, quite often there's a regulatory reason why you cannot substitute out. So in that sense, I do wonder whether, even if you get past all of the issues with observable prices, can you actually genuinely say there is a lease and a service, when actually your choice is you buy the whole service, including the aircraft, or you don't do the deal?
I will, in the interest of time, I will take only one view from the auditors. So can you decide between yourselves which one?
I did want to echo Peter's comments about the concerns around the examples. We're finding when we talk to people, everyone seems to have a very clear view as to what's in and what's out. But when you start talking to them, those clear views don't match. And we think there is considerable, we have considerable concern as to the consistent applications arising from the principles and the examples. And we think the big concern that we think is there is that the examples, and examples are useful, so we're not saying delete them, but we don't think they link back to the principles sufficiently. So that we don't say why is the example there, what's it trying to explain, and there are concerns that the examples contradict each other. So we do have a large concern around that, and believe there could definitely be inconsistent application on what is in and what's out scope.
Julian.
Thank you. I've got a couple of quick ones. The first one is on supply agreements with embedded leases in them. Whether the accounting standard would treat these on the basis of cost plus or simply cost, simply because if we've got an obligation to pay rent, typically we've got an obligation to pay a margin on that rent within that supply agreement. So just to try and understand how that would work. And the other is the other end of the supply agreement, where a lot of our members have or manage office buildings or industrial buildings where they've got third-party services, restaurant services, post rooms, and so on and so forth, where effectively they're granting the use of space. Does that mean that that's automatically going to be treated as a lease, as a bundled lease, even if we're not charging them rent for that space, because it's part of that service? So just to understand a bit.
Any reaction from the staff on this question?
No, I mean, I think just to address your second point, is that are you talking about common areas or common
space? No, so if we have we've got a canteen in our head office building, for example. Our catering firm looks after that entire area. It's our space. It's our equipment that they're using to prepare meals from, that the economic contract they're providing to us is a ticket price meal to staff. Now, under those circumstances, we've given them the space within their agreement.
But you control that space, do you?
Well, they pretty much control that space within that agreement because
it's a joint control in a way.
are we allowed into it if we want to go in? Yeah, absolutely. But they're there to do a particular job, and the contract requires them to do that job in that space.
I can only give a personal view, and clearly that's very bad to make in the public domain, that it doesn't sound to me, based on your 30 seconds of explaining that, I would doubt that a lease would exist in that contract, but that's my personal view based on your 30 second explanation.
Jane?
Yeah, just to echo the earlier comments around guidance and the principle, I think it's important, if we're certainly trying to remove some of the costs for preparers, to give as much clarity in the guidance. For example, in the substitution point, you know, one of the concerns we're getting feedback is how much do I have to demonstrate or evidence that it's taking place? The fact that it exists in my contract should be sufficient. And again, it's just making sure that the guidance reflects that. We know that the views that we're getting back from the preparers is that they do need to have a conversation with the auditor, and the auditor really needs to hang their hat on something to say, yes, it's in the guidance, therefore you've done as principal, rather than having to demonstrate that activity. And I guess that's the flow through, whether it's informal contracts. We're already getting a lot of concerns. Our members lease out a number of thousands of vehicle leasing, and the customers are really sort of asking the question, what's an informal contract, what's a formal extension? They're looking for clarity. And again, anything that the board can do to help give that level of clarity will remove some of the costs on the preparers.
Thank you. Well, I see the time is running, and maybe you will have an opportunity in the closing comments, Pascal, to come back. And maybe we should move to the last series of questions about transition and any other practical proposals. Katrina, question 12 and 13, I suppose, are we now?
Yeah, that's right. Just moving on to the last sort of set of official questions, and this is called other aspects. So I suppose it's any other particular comments that you have on other aspects of the proposals. In the paper, we highlighted two areas that we're particularly interested in your thoughts on, which is any views you have around transition and disclosure. But also, I'd just say if you have any other comments on other aspects of the proposals, then we'd be interested in hearing them.
I'm sure you have plenty of comments about disclosures. Some will say not enough, some say too much. Right, who wants to begin? Transition first, maybe? Comparatives? That's the question for Todd, I think.
Sorry?
The comparatives. This question for you, maybe. Okay, no. I will let you go when you want.
Sorry.
No questions about that?
Everybody happy? Okay.
Okay. Challenge. I was just checking our comment letter here, and when I first read the transition guidance, my first read was, that seems sensible. But we've ended up writing more paragraphs on the transition proposals in our comment letter than any other topic. I wouldn't want to bore anyone rigid by getting down to detail, but it does suggest that there are certain quite obvious transitional issues that haven't been addressed. Like, for example, a lease that is currently considered an onerous operating lease is, what happens to the provision? It just doesn't appear to be there. But the broadest issue, I think, and quite happy to engage separately with Petrina and team on the detail, but the broader issue is that we would support the need for a modified retrospective approach. I think that's a good thing. But when you bear in mind where the project has now ended up around lease term being a lot shorter than was considered back in 2010, variable rents being included to a lesser degree in the lease asset and liability than was the case back in 2010, I question now whether the modified retrospective approach actually for Type A leases is simple enough. I don't think that there would be a huge loss in information value, and given the probably lesser arguments there are now about front loading on transition with those two facets I've just mentioned, whether actually you might just treat lease type A and type B leases similarly on transition, which is make the asset and liability equal and opposite. The idea for a type B projecting forward, then going back to the beginning of time and coming forward again, if you have a large volume of those types of leases, just sounds a step too far.
David?
Yeah, I think on transition, I think there are sort of practical difficulties implying the modified, particularly for the lessor, if you're going from an operating lease to a type A, having to obtain current values for your assets is somewhat onerous. We've got lots of small ticket leases.
What's the solution?
I think probably on that one is to allow one just to assume there is no deferred gain, and therefore assume that the value equals the carrying value prior to that. But I think also the other thing is for the finance leases, where you can carry on essentially the same accounting as at present, which sounds great for the transition, but going forward it then means you've got to have two separate systems and processes to deal with variations to leases after that. So, you know, you've got to decide whether this variation relates to a new lease or an old lease and have a different accounting for that. So you're going to end up with a dual accounting system for many years if you've got sort of ship leases or aircraft leases. And again, I think there's some sort of
What
process of trying to build, well, probably if you make the variable lease accounting the same as it is at current, that problem will go away.
Would you permit that the existing finance lease be restated under the new system as an option or as accounting?
Well, yes, perhaps more flexibility in how one deals with the issues. Because obviously it's going to be different for every lessor. And again, it comes back to this, it's fairly prescriptive at the moment in how one does a modified. Again, if it was sort of, they were given as examples of what you could do rather than you must do this, and which allows some flexibility for other acceptable approximations which can then be agreed with the auditors as being reasonable approximations. The other area, which is not transition, but sale and lease backs is another area of concern I have, where essentially if you don't meet the sales test or you have a finance lease back, it's essentially outside the scope. First of all, I'm not quite sure why we're taking them out of scope, because it says in the basis of conclusions that the reason for having a separate leasing standard to deal with, say, lease liabilities, rather than referring to IAS 39 or IFRS 9, is because there are unique features of leases which require a different accounting approach. Why doesn't that equally apply to a lease back, under a sale and lease back? And particularly, if you fall into IFRS 9, you're going to get into fair valuing of your lease receivable or lease payable, which seems, why have such a different accounting for what is essentially a lease? And also, the assumption that because you fail the revenue test for a sale, then you've automatically got a financing, again, that's not going to be correct. What if your lease liability is less than the sale proceeds? How do you account for that? For example, you have a 10-year, you sell something with an option to buy back in 10 years' time, but then you enter into a one-year lease back. So you've got 1 year of obligations, but you're supposed to account for that as a financing. You know, and now, the revenue ED used to deal with that by saying you've effectively got an operating lease and operating lease back, but I understand the proposals to take that out. I think it needs to be put back.
maybe I'll continue with preparers. Norbert?
Yeah. On transition, I guess, interestingly, when we asked our IT folks and our accounting shared service center, they actually think that they would rather have two systems working rather than moving everything to the new accounting standard. They think it's not manageable to revisit hundreds of thousands of contracts that we indeed do have, and the costs would be enormous. So they actually would suggest having new systems, implementing new systems prospectively, dealing with new leases under the new standard, which was surprising to me, but it seems to be, from a cost perspective, a better way to do this. Then I have one comment. Our company is, and I haven't really mentioned this earlier, but when we lessor, we don't view ourselves as typical lessors. We don't have really assets where we look at the residual value and so forth. And I think that drives also the thinking currently that, there's a thought currently going on whether intercompany leases within, segment reporting should actually all be accounted for currently under current rules, under IFRS 8, as operating leases. Because management thinks, that's a better way to manage our assets, manage our contracts, and allocate revenues and so forth to these contracts. Having listened to, there's so many stakeholders, so many discussions, and I don't think that there will be hopefully any intention to change IFRS 8 out of this project, but there's a few discussions that the FASB is having on related party leases and so forth. So we'd like to urge the board at least to keep current IFRS 8 intact, where companies can choose an accounting policy for how they want to deal with intercompany or intersegment contracts. Because if companies come to the conclusion that the standard, hopefully not, but if the standard is nonsensical for them internally, that they have an option to apply a different accounting policy or accounting measurement to their intercompany or intersegment lease transactions.
I can speak for FSB, but for ISB, we have no plans to change the IFRS 8 for that purpose. We may have some other restrictions on things like reconciling the segment reporting results differently, maybe, but certainly not changing the requirements.
No, I was going to just confirm to Norbert that at least personally I have no intention of taking on more issues beyond leases and incorporated at present. I can't speak for the board.
En d'autres temps presse, maybe c'est about said on his back, maybe.
I wanted just to pick up on David's point about sale and leaseback accounting and to say that we are and we always have been highly supportive of the overall intent of the boards with the lease project. But right now, the single thing that we have most conceptual difficulty with is what seems to us to be a change to sale and leaseback accounting that would result in us recognising, I choose my words carefully, surpluses and shortfalls rather than profits and losses. At the time at which we take an aircraft that is owned and we effectively change its status to a leased aircraft. And I think particularly with a business model which is totally about operation of aircraft and only at the very, very incidental margins anything to do with trading aircraft, and that's only when the aircraft no longer has any use to us. If we're taken into a place, whether consciously or unconsciously, where we are recognising profits and losses, I think that results in an income statement pattern which users, analysts will find very, very difficult to understand, to interpret. I think the difficulty comes as much as anything from maybe I'm reading the words in too binary a nature, but it seems to me that for the typical arrangement that we have got, we would always recognise a sale. But I think I would question, what is it that you're actually selling? If it's a brand new aircraft, you sell and lease it back on day one for a term of 10 years. Are you selling that brand new aircraft, or are you forward selling your 10-year-old aircraft? And I think for us, the latter interpretation makes a lot more sense.
And just to clarify, under IS 17 today, mm-hmm. it's not treated as a sale.
Under IAS 17 today, every fact pattern we have seen so far results in a deferral.
Michael, it's Eli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Monahan, American Council of Life Insurers. On transition, we agree that for certain long-term and or significant leases, the proposed modified full or full retrospective approaches are appropriate. However, for leases such as water coolers and copiers, we do not believe the information would justify the cost in obtaining it. Thank you.
Mike Vinnis.
Thank you. Yeah, just another point on sale and leaseback is just to urge you to be cautious not to catch the sort of sale and leaseback which is a simple route to title for small equipment lessees. It happens quite a lot that there is a sale and then a lease back. It's simply a way of the lessor getting its title. It would be a pity if they got caught up in those rules, so you need to deal with those. Disclosures. I mean, clearly the disclosures are very extensive. I would really draw your attention to the disclosures that consist in the roll forward and reconciliation. They are going to be extremely difficult for people to properly document and going to be a major contributor to the cost and complexity of implementing the proposals. I would point to that as being probably excessive. I'd also point to the fact that on type B leases you still have to disclose the interest charge and so on, which I think to me once again casts discredit on the whole type B model. If you're not going to show the interest in the P&L, well, why do you still have to calculate it and disclose it? But the roll forward table is extraordinarily difficult in the disclosures.
Thanks. I was a bit surprised not to hear more about disclosures, but I'm sure that Simon is going back to that issue.
Yes, indeed. Obviously, as I represent preparers, it's probably no surprise to hear that I'm coming more from the point of view of the disclosures
which can be reduced rather than disclosures that can be increased. And I just want to back up Mark's comment about the roll forward tables from a lessee's perspective. I would challenge why these have to be done separately for type A and type B leases for a full roll forward. I would question what that is really adding. So that's the one thing I would home in most of all. Generally, I think this fits with concerns about disclosure framework generally. I won't sort of say more on that.
Can I just ask a clarifying either of Mark and of Simon? I think, can I take your comments to that from your perspective, you would think that those role, having to provide that roll forward information potentially requires specific systems changes or a lot of extra cost only to provide the disclosures that wouldn't be necessary, for example, if we just took recognition and measurement but not?
I think it's much more of a lessee problem than a lessor problem. Yeah, I think it will require specific systems work. It's very much linked to the frequency of reassessment as well, because what you're saying is that every time you do a reassessment, you've got to stop the movement, tot it up at the end of the accounting period, present it, make sure it all reconciles back and so on. Those are just things that operationally and IT, in IT terms, tend to be nightmares for IT people and for people who use the output from the IT system.
Don, a regulator's view on disclosures, maybe, or transition?
Undoubtedly. Regarding the disclosures, we assessed the disclosures and came to the conclusion that they seems to be useful for investors, but finally, investors have to decide if they are useful or not. Regarding the transition, we support the retrospective application for the sake of comparability. We understand the concerns as expressed by David. We ask for further relief or for more options regarding transition. But we would like to stress that it is important for comparability reasons that the board is rather restrictive in this area and is looking for the right balance between the information loss for investors and cost for preparers. And then we have one other comment, and it is not mentioned here, and it is the classification of the right of use asset in the balance sheet. When we go through the current proposals for us, it is not clear if it will be a intangible or tangible asset or dependent on what is the asset underlying. We would like to encourage the board to clarify this, because for investors, the difference between the two is important, I think.
I know it's very important for some regulatory purposes for banks, but I would like to ask Jed and Peter, do you really think that having this right of use being classified as tangible or intangible, or as it is today, undefined, is so important?
I think for quite a few people it might be, particularly people who are using data vendors to download data, and they're disaggregating between tangible and intangible, and where people put it is important. From my perspective, I would absolutely see them as tangible. You are using a tangible asset in order to deliver your operational profitability, and it's that you're trying to generate a return against. So I think, yes, you do need to think about that. The other thing I would say is that one of the things that came out from Petrina's earlier discussion was that different users will be using the information in different ways depending on their perspective, whether that's equity analysts trying to effectively calculate a whole asset type thing, or credit analysts really focused on the enforceable obligations, and a whole range of ways people are thinking about it in between. And I'd say when you look at the disclosure pack, that actually therefore says that you need more disclosure in order to enable users to look at it from all those different angles.
Just to build on Jed's point, on the one hand, a right of use asset appears to meet the definition of an intangible, but for all intents and purposes, the way the standard is written, these are tangible. it becomes critical when you move into regulated industries, particularly banks. Is it or is it not a risk-weighted asset? Now, it's not your problem. That's for the bank regulator to sort out, but I'm sure a number of people from the banking industry will be making that observation to you. On the disclosure... on the disclosure, I'm saying this at 1 minute to 12... so that this way you won't have time to ask me what I would do instead. For businesses with a large volume of lease contracts, a lot of the disclosure presented will be boilerplate. And it's unavoidable if you have hundreds of thousands of contracts to describe interest rates, options, extension options, variable rents in any meaningful way will be very challenging. But no, I don't know what you would do instead.
Thanks a lot. Well, we're coming to an end. I think we have 2 minutes left. Does anyone want to make any very quick concluding remark? Not repeating what has been said so far. Or does any of my colleagues of the two boards have any questions on this morning's session? If not, thank you very much for your very active participation, a lot of engagement, very good explanations. I think it's quite useful to us, and look forward to the continuation.
Thank you.